Another interesting interview, but go ahead.
Let me, oops, hang on. Oops. Yes, so we are recording. That's strange. The little thing didn't come up automatically. Yeah, interesting. Any rate, so they must have changed the way the settings work. At any rate, let me say for the record that it is 2:15 in the afternoon on the 12th of January 2021, and we are doing our fourth session together. I'm Tacy Ann Rosalowski, and I'm talking with Catherine DeAngelis today. And we ended our session last week with you saying, and so I was editor-in-chief of JAMA, and the rest is history. So I want to hear all about that. I mean, that's
that 11 and a half year history there. First of all, I told you about how I got to be the editor.
You did. That was. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now I walk in and I interviewed, my first day. I'm thinking, I'm coming from Hopkins, and I'm so used to being surrounded by people who are just absolutely phenomenal. What am I walking into? Well, what I was walking into was a group of fantastic, wonderful people. Very bright, very dedicated, just wonderful people. So
were they all MDs like yourself? I mean, what was the breakdown?
Let's see. There were, no, the editors were all MDs. But there are a lot of other people. I mean, there were like 100 and some people all together. And because remember, there were now, there was JAMA, and then there were 10 archives journals. And all the editors, as I said, I had some full-time editors that were, those were the people that I worked with at the building where the JAMA office was. But there were 10 or 11 other offices where the editors were all over the place. I mean, they were, over the years there, I had to name new editors of different ones, but people I worked with on a day-to-day basis are the ones that were just fantastic. Well, one of them was a nurse. One is a nurse. She's a deputy editor. The others were manuscript editors, and they were not. They had master's degrees mostly, but they were manuscript editors. They were fantastic. And the woman in charge, she had a master's degree too. But all the editors who were full-time except for the nurse. And she was great because she sort of put it all together like nurses do. And so, it was just beautiful because we would have these meetings twice a week. We would meet and go over manuscripts. We received, when I went there, we were getting about 3,500 manuscripts a year. And within 2 years, I think it was, we were getting 6,000.
Now, let me ask you before we get too deeply into, the weeds with this, a couple of things. First of all, what was your status vis-a-vis Hopkins once you took on this role?
I was a professor. And when I left, it was just beautiful. I mean, they when I left Hopkins, they had it was supposed to be a little reception, but there were about 100 people who showed up. And at one point, this was very touching for me because it was in the evening, like about 6-7 o'clock. And at one point, one of the people who was maintenance people came out and asked if I would just step away for just a few minutes, go into the kitchen, which I did. And there were about 30 or 40 maintenance, housekeeping, diet kitchen, they were there and they wanted to say goodbye too. And some of them had stayed from the day shift just to do that. And that was just so beautiful for me.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, leaving, and then I was leaving my husband. We planned that we were going to have this this marriage where we would, one or the other would visit, either I'd come to Baltimore or he'd come to Chicago. That lasted about 5 months before he took a leave of absence. No, I guess it lasted 4 months. He took a leave of absence and then he came to live with me because we didn't do well not being together. It was
long distance is tough. Yeah. Now let me ask you, when you took on the JAMA role, you know, how did you think of your mission in that role? You know, what was it that you wanted to accomplish, your vision?
I wanted to make this a real academic journal. So that, I mean, everybody grew up, including me, with New England Journal of Medicine. I mean, that still remains the number one journal because it, you know, it always has been the academic journal. But I wanted to get us so that, okay, we can be number two, but we wouldn't be that far behind and that we would vie with the New England Journal for key papers. And we were able to do it because mostly what I wanted to do was to, in many cases, I would call, I asked all the editors or anybody if they knew of an important research project that was going on to let me know. And who was the principal investigator? And I would call them and, you know, solicit, you know, give us a chance. And there are people that I knew that were doing important research. And so I would call, you know, I'd call them because I knew them. And I said, just give us a chance. Just send this and give me a chance. And it, after a while, our impact factor, which I think is terrible, but that's what people go by. Our impact factor when I walked in the door was 11 and a half. When I walked out the door, it was 31.
Wow.
And if you go up half a point a year, it was supposedly wonderful. But, you know, it just started to just increase like crazy. And we were getting some really terrific papers. We'd go to the different meetings and then we would do podcasts and stuff like that. We were doing all kinds of things.
Hmm. Now, did you, you know, you brought your equity mindset, gender equity mindset to this role as well. I mean, tell me how you acted on that.
Okay, so I did two things. Number one, with the equity, when we'd get these clinical trials, now the clinical trial is, that's the epitome of research. Everything else just shows association. But clinical trials show that something is directly related to, okay? So what when I would get a paper, I'd look at it and they'd sort of mix everything together. And I'd say, no, I want you to separate out the women and the men. And very often there would be not enough women in the thing for them to be able to be able to look at them in the same way as far as what were the traits and what were the what was the outcome. And so the message got out that, you know, I really wanted, I wanted them to enlist as many women as men, and not just say, because we began to show that the outcomes were different in women than men. And so they got the message, and then other journals kind of followed through. And I think one of the biggest things that helped us with women was that I convinced, you know, the women's health study. That was the big study about the use of estrogen, progesterone, the birth control pill, or the pill that you would, how much would you take when you went through menopause? And Jeff Drazen, the editor of New England Journal of Medicine, who's a really terrific guy, we became very good friends. That was his paper. Everybody knew that was going to New England Journal. But I called the principal investigator and worked with her and said, give us a chance. Mm-hmm. And we published that paper. Oh, my goodness. But it helped a lot. You know, there was a lot of coverage of that. You know, some people said, oh, no, that wasn't right. This wasn't right. But what happened was many other studies came from that study. It was stimulated by that. And we certainly got our share of those, too. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing I did was I wanted at least whenever I could, I tried to put at least a paper about children. And we had a pediatric archives of pediatrics and adolescent medicine, which I had been the editor of before JAMA. We would publish, we published a fair number of them, almost every issue, not quite, but almost every issue. But it also stimulated people to send their journals, send their article to us. And then if we wouldn't publish it, we could then offer the author to send all the material that they put together for us, to send it right over to the editor of the specialty journal, like pediatrics or cardiology or neurology. And we couldn't guarantee that it would be published there, but the fact that we would send it on, we didn't send all of them on because some of them I didn't think were, I thought there were other places that where it could be published, not in our archives. But what it did was help the impact factor of the specialty journals, the archive journals. And because they would submit their best articles to us, and then if we didn't publish them, almost always they'd say, yeah, go ahead, because they'd save a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So that helped too.
What was your approach to women authors and representation among the authors?
Well, this was the thing. I mean, we knew that there were articles that were, if women were the chief author on it, that they were reviewed differently. But that didn't happen with us. In fact, we encouraged the women to submit to us. I mean, they're good articles. And
What did others, you said they were reviewed differently. What were the kinds of parameters?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that I actually tested this. I never published it, but I would send out, this was before, not as the editor, but I did this before. I'd send an article to somebody, and I'd put a man's name first. It's the same article, and I'd put the woman's name on after that. I'd send them out to different people, and inevitably, the guy's name on the paper came out much higher than the woman's name on the paper. And I said, you know, that's not acceptable. And so we never did that, and we encouraged the women to submit and to put their names first or last. The senior author is usually the last author. So, but you know, you could only do so much. And I also use that as a means to, other thing I did to stimulate getting articles. I did a special issue. We did theme issues two or three times a year. And then we'd have a special meeting where we would present that. But we would present some of the papers from that, and we'd invite the newspapers. We'd have, okay. So I did one fairly early on, a special theme issue on women. And it was funny because that stimulated a lot of good papers, that they were papers about women, and a lot of them had the author was also a woman, but it didn't have to be. Just the article had to be about women. So it was interesting because in a podcast, I would every week, and I'll tell you the story about podcasts in a minute, but every week I would do a podcast about what was coming in that week's issue. Just briefly go over some of the key factors about the key issues and different things. And so this issue with the women, I said to the men, I said in the podcast, okay, this week's issue is the special theme issue on women. And the media meeting that we'll have about this will take place, and I think it was in the Waldorf Astoria in New York, because we try to do them in New York, because you know a lot of media there are in Washington, but I said now. Don't worry, guys, because we're going to do a special theme issue on men. And I'm thinking about having the media meeting at Hooters. Well, it was amazing the feedback I got about that.
I bet. Dr. DeAngelis, let me pause just for 1 second.
Let me get off.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that.
I couldn't hear anything. I was going to say there's nothing on.
Yeah. No, it's, I could definitely hear it. So.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, I know it's quite amazing how sensitive the recorders are these days.
Yeah.
Amazing. So you were going to say a little more about the podcast. So,
okay. About, I don't know, 3-4 years into it, New England Journal, now you got to remember that New England Journal is owned by the Massachusetts Medical Society. It's a very good society, okay? But JAMA, who is owned by the American Medical Association, much larger, okay? So journals are cash cows. They make a lot of money. And New England Journal of Medicine makes a lot of money, and so did JAMA. But what the difference was with New England Journal of Medicine, essentially, you know, 90%+ of what they made went back into making the journal better they could spend on all kinds of things that they could do. That was not true for JAMA. Our money, you know, went to the AMA, and they used it to fund all kinds of things. And we just got a certain amount, and it certainly was nowhere near what New England Journal got. So a few years in, one of the things that the New England Journal of Medicine did was they hired professional people to do a podcast. And so they were pretty well received. You know, people like to tune in or while they're running or driving, you could hear and you could get a lot of information. So, you know, I didn't have any money in my budget to hire somebody to do that. I mean, that was a pretty expensive thing. So I talked to our people and I said, look, you know, I'd love to do this, but we don't have the money. And they said, well, why don't you do it? I said, me? And they said, yeah, you do it. And we'll set it up here. We have the mechanism where we can set it up, but you do it. I said, well, I'll try it. Let's see what happens. So I started, and you know, I have a weird sense of humor, in case you didn't notice. But I'd start out with, hello out there. This is Kathy DeAngelis, the editor-in-chief of JAMA. You know, blah, blah, blah. I didn't, no. It went over really big because I throw in zingers all the time. I, you know, throw in a funny liner here or there. And one day, probably after I'd done three or four of them, I'm walking at the O'Hare Airport because there was a lot of travel involved. And somebody came up to me and said, hello out there. And it happened frequently thereafter. I mean, they'd recognize me and say, hello out there. So they liked it. Yeah, they really liked it. So we did it and it didn't cost us anything.
Right. And the podcast that helped kind of drive the profile of the journal.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And it's, you know, they continue the podcast now with they have much more sophisticated thing because I never had a publisher. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should say I had about five publishers. They kept changing and none of them were interested in anything except making money so that it could go for the AMA. After I left, they hired a real publisher who was wonderful. In fact, he was a former publisher, assistant publisher for the New England Journal of Medicine. And he came in and things were different, which is good. That's the way it should be. I thought that was wonderful. But, you know, you work, you do the best you can with what you have.
Mm-hmm. What were some really, really challenging scenarios that you had to take on during that editor-in-chief role?
Well, there was always this issue with the board of trustees were made up. I mean, they were really decent, nice people, but they were private practice. And so for the most part, hadn't a clue about academia or about academic freedom or editorial freedom. And one of the things that was very important to me and the deal I made with this CEO when I came in was that I reported to a journal oversight committee, not to the board, and that they then would translate to the board and to the CEO. Well, the original CEO left and the person who came in wasn't exactly, he was all for himself. And he also was nowhere near as smart or as accomplished as the other person, as the original one. So what would happen? is that, you know, I published something and someone said, well, you know, that's not our policy, or that's not what the AMA wants. Well, I said, that's fine. And they wanted us to publish some of their stuff, like they wanted us to publish something from the president. And I said, we are not the newsletter for the AMA.
Yeah,
we
are
an editorially independent journal. Well, they wanted, you know, they didn't like that. They wanted to have a say in what we published. And so we got into this back and forth. And I refused to do that. I said, my contract says editorial freedom. The journal oversight is who I report to, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you're bound to get into some kinds of messes because there was, you know, a misunderstanding that occurred between my deputy editor and one of the authors, who was dishonest as the day is long. And they got into this mess. And there was, you know, supposedly they were going to, they said all kinds of terrible things about me because I protected him, as I should, because the buck stopped with me. And, you know, it got pretty rough, and we had to get the Journal Oversight Committee involved to investigate this supposed thing. And everything came out okay, but it was not easy. And that EVP CEO was not very helpful. And, you know, it's things like that. But, you know, it's interesting. When I left, they let him go. But he was... Anyway, it doesn't matter. He tried to make me go so that he could have whatever, and of course that didn't work out because I worked with the board and they knew, and there was all kinds of issues. But the person who came in, who is now the EVP, the executive vice president, or the chief operating officer, chief executive officer, is someone who I wish we had worked together. And he had said he wishes that we had worked together because it would have been a lot smoother sailing. Mm-hmm. But hey, you do the best you can with what you have.
And it sounds like you were able to sail through that or navigate through it.
It was tacking.
I changed my wording there. But it sounds like you were able to do it without.
It's interesting. I really believe that, well, I certainly believe in God. And I think that given time, as I think we're seeing now in our country, things work out. And so right now, we both left at the same time, but I went on to continue to be a faculty member at Hopkins and became a distinguished service professor, which is the highest ranking you could achieve, and not too many people achieve it. And I'm still very active. He is in private practice. Mm-hmm. Because nobody will hire him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because the truth was out. I mean, he took credit for, you know, oh, look, I made the AMA financially healthy. And no, it was a woman who did it, actually. Denise Haggerty.
Yeah.
Although somebody said to me, you know, that guy Dennis Haggerty is really a sharp financial person. I said, yeah, she is, but her name is Denise, not Dennis. A wonderful woman.
So as you look back over your entire tenure with JAMA, you know, what are some of the additional accomplishments that you feel, you know, you were really able to make? I mean, you mentioned the high impact factor and several other things, maintaining the intellectual and editorial freedom of the journal. What were some other things that you felt you were really able to accomplish?
Well, I think we established ourselves as being a really high-powered journal. And an academic journal. And things that came out of JAMA were considered to be pretty top-notch. And so, the top three journals are New England Journal, JAMA, and Lancet. But Lancet is based in Britain. And so, to get to that level was wonderful.
What did that do for the AMA to have the journal?
Oh, it did a lot because, it was the Journal of the American Medical Association. So that's what JAMA is. It's mm-hmm. it's their journal, but they own it. But they don't have anything to do with the content. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Which is very important. We're not the notebook for the AMA. We're their academic journal, as are all the other journals, the specialty journals.
Why did you decide to leave that position?
Well, I originally went in to I was going to stay 10 years. And that would have meant that I finished in 2010. But I decided I wanted to stay a couple of years to sort of make that transition. And the other thing is that the EVP, the bad guy, tried to get rid of me. He was trying to, and I figured, oh, yeah? So I said, I wasn't going to leave on his grounds. I would leave on mine. Mm-hmm. And so the board said to him, he couldn't do that. And so what I did, though, but I didn't want to stay much longer because I had taken the journal as far as I could. And I knew the next editor could take it the next levels. And so, there were things I wanted to have JAMA Cardiology, JAMA Neurology. But the best I could do was I joined. That was the other big thing I did. It wasn't JAMA and then the archives over here. It was JAMA and the archives. I changed the logo. The JAMA and archives, we were one family. But we were not JAMA Neurology, JAMA this, JAMA that. And I knew that...
I'm sorry, what was the significance of that? Why was that so important?
Well, because to have a family of journals means that you're covering all kinds of grounds. And as I said before, you could submit something to JAMA in cardiology, but it wouldn't quite make it for us, or we didn't have room, or we already published something like that. But you would go to, JAMA Cardiology or whatever, or JAMA Neurology or whatever. And there was, there was a strength in that.
Mm-hmm. But and I sort knew of share, it sounds like a shared quality as well.
Well, it was. And we were a family of journals. Mm-hmm. And I'm into families. I think that's a very, very strong thing to have is family. I knew that if we went to JAMA Neurology, JAMA Psychiatry, that when you change the name, your impact factor goes to zero. So you have to start all over. So this would be a 2-3-4 year venture. And I wasn't going to stay that long. About 2 years, it would be 3-4 year venture. And I didn't want to stay that long at that point. I mean, I wanted to go back to come back to Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And so I made a deal with them that I'd give a 2-year contract, but that I'd leave after a year and a half. That's why I served as 11 and a half years. I'd leave after and just do, I mean, they'd continue to pay me and I'd have all everything. But I wouldn't be present there. I didn't want to stand in the way of the new editor. But I'd do whatever the AMA wanted me to, which I knew was not much, wasn't anything really. But it meant that they paid me. So I sort of had a 6-month sabbatical at the end. Although I came right back to Hopkins. And So
tell me about going back to Hopkins.
Well, the first thing I wanted, I wanted to set up something with professionalism. And, but I wanted, my mentors were after me to write a lot of the stories about that I used to help them, because I continued mentoring people all the time I was at JAMA. And they kept after me. They said, why don't you write the memoir and why don't you write these stories and so that they can be shared? So I said, I'm going to write these stories. Well, as I started to write the stories, I thought, these stories out of context of where they fit in my life and how I came up with they were stories about things that I had done and why I had done them, administratively and that stuff. So I said, I got to put this in context. So I ended up writing my memoir. And because I then wanted that journal, that book, my memoirs, because I wanted it to come out fast, I'm going through the process now, which I'll come back to in a minute. But it takes a long time to find an agent and then publish. It's not like I've published 14 books, but 13 of them are academics. So you deal directly with the editor and publisher. But that's not how novels are handled. You have to find an agent before you go to a publisher. And that takes a long time. And I didn't want a long time. I wanted to have the book so that I can use it for mentoring. So I self-published it. And it did very well. It's still selling. It's bizarre. But I use it for mentoring. I still use it for mentoring.
Let me ask you, what was the process of writing like? Did you learn some things as you were thinking about your past experiences and putting them in context in that way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, you've read it now, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
What are some
realizations that you came to?
Well, a lot of them are when I put that at the end of the thing, life's lessons learned. I think it allowed me to think about my life and what I had learned. And it's very interesting because when you write, first of all, you expose yourself. I mean, you say things that, you know, maybe it would be a bit, you know, they're private things, but if you really want to help people, then you're going to have to expose that. You have to put it in context. So that's what I learned. But it's interesting, if you want to jump forward now, I mean, I've spent this COVID issue. My husband and I, and actually the end of June, went up to our house. We have a family house in northeastern Pennsylvania on the Delaware River. Very rural. It's like safe, you know. There's nothing there but beauty. It's nature. We're right on the Delaware River. It's great. But I said, you know, I always have to have a project. And since I could no longer go into the hospital every day because of COVID, I said, you know, I've always wanted to write a mystery, a murder mystery. So I said, I'm going to write a murder mystery. That's all I had in my head. I had no idea about what. And so I, at the in throughout June, I started at, I guess, the end of May, beginning of June, I sort of went through different things in my head about, you know, okay, yeah, this will take place in a hospital. Now I got to think about this. But when I got up to Pennsylvania at the end of June, every day I take a 3-mile walk on the road along the river. It's beautiful nature. There's like not much there, but nature. And I just, it was so astounding because it gave me time to think about my own life. And I think when you do that, you go through this existential question or struggle, which I was going through. And I'd come back and I'd say, well, you know, you got to write. And I'd sit down and I'd start to write. I had no idea about what I was going to write until I sat down and started to write. And then I'd go for a walk the next day, come back, and I'd start to write. And suddenly, well, not suddenly, I wrote a novel. And I truly believe, oh, it taught me a lot about myself. Hmm. It taught me a lot about life.
What were some of the lessons learned?
Oh.
If you want to share them.
Are you a Christian? You're Christian.
I am not.
You're not. No. Are you Jewish?
No, but I'm very open to hearing spirit.
You're open to, okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have asked that. It's none of my business. But it's a story about a woman physician who was a former nun who left the convent, actually got married, but her husband was killed after only less than 2 years in a freak accident. And she went to medical school and became the chief medical officer in a Catholic hospital. And she discovers that the death of 2 patients that didn't sit right with her, et cetera, et cetera. But in the meantime, she's going through an existential crisis, much as I was. But I wasn't, I wouldn't say it, I was going through a crisis. I was going through a struggle. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself, her character, I was writing my own stuff into it. Mm-hmm. And in trying to write that part, the book has 2 parallel plots. One is the murder mystery. The other is the existential struggle. And they weave in and out with each other until the end when they come together for a resolution.
Do you mind sketching what that existential struggle was for you?
I can't do it because then I'd tell you all about the book.
Okay. Fair enough. I'd be happy
to send you a copy of the book right now. One of the things I learned, I wrote the book. It's done. Well,
congratulations. That's great. That's a great achievement.
Well, yeah, and I'm happy with it. And I learned so much that I came to grips with my own existential struggle. Like, what's my role in life? Why am I here? Have I really done what I'm supposed to have done? You know, and in fact, writing the book was an incredible struggle because at times, it's a good thing I'm married to a psychiatrist, because I said to him, there were times when I thought I was dealing with the parallel universe. Because this family that I was writing about and this hospital and the whole scenario, there were times when I couldn't write it because it was so strong. And there were other times, even now, I mean, I could picture that every character in this book, I picture the hospital, I know the house where they live, I know the place, I know everything about it. It's like, I know there's a parallel. I wonder if there's a place, a parallel universe. But I read a lot. I read a lot of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Tillich and, well, just a lot of, and then, you know, I mean, it's sort of like, do you like Flannery O'Connor?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Okay, well, she's the most beautiful existential writer. That's what she was writing about. So I said my book is sort of Flannery O'Connor meets Harlan Coben. Harlan mm-hmm. Coben is a mystery writer. Do you ever read any of his mysteries?
I may have. I'm sure I have. I recognize the name.
Yeah, but he's a mystery writer, you know. And so
did you come to a decision about your own sense of purpose, you know, the big why question?
Yes, mm-hmm. of course. That's mm-hmm. what writing the book did. Mm-hmm. And an understanding of my faith.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, the whole thing is she's struggling. She believes strongly in justice, and which I do, but in you know, what is, how do you truly get justice? And I mean, is murder in this particular case? Because she finds out that the murderer is someone that she respects and admires very much, and is a very decent man. And he murdered, really, these two patients for good reasons, very good reasons. These men were terrible. There's very little redeeming grace about either of them. And so when she finally, when he, there's a chaplain of the hospital who becomes a good friend of hers. I mean, he's older than her mother, but he's like 80 and she's 48. So, but he becomes part of the family because she lives with her mother now because her dad died and her husband's gone. And it's interesting because she's interested in truth and then justice. So the truth for her was she knows that these two patients died. And it doesn't sit right with her. She does this because she becomes the chief medical officer. And in trying to put together data and so she could understand everything about the hospital, she finds these two deaths that somehow were they seemed weird to her, even though both had autopsies and they were signed off as they couldn't find anything abnormal about them because of the clever way this guy who was a maintenance man. and I'm giving away the plot, so I hope this doesn't come out before my book does.
We don't.
Okay. Anyway, she realizes, because he confesses to her, he writes a letter and he confesses to her. And so she decides, can murder or any any really terrible sin be forgiven. And then she realizes that no matter what sin, she realizes why Jesus, who and what Jesus is, and why he suffered this incredibly horrible death to make up for any sin we have. So that there is no sin, that if you truly are sorry for it and ask for forgiveness, it's always there. Because it's paid for, the justice is Jesus' blood in his life. And if you're not Christian, then you probably don't quite understand what I'm saying, but
Intellectually I certainly can. No, I don't have background.
Flannery O'Connor, you know, she's struggling with that.
But these are, you know, serious questions, you know, about fundamental issues for all people, you know, the nature of forgiveness, the nature
The book.
Why was that question so important to you right now that you wanted to take it on?
I have no idea. I have no idea why I wrote that. I have no idea where it came from.
Something inside you was percolating on that.
I guess. And it just came. And that's why I really want to have this published.
Yeah.
Because I've had three people read it. Three totally different people. One is someone who edits a lot of books. One is someone who was the editor for Simon and Schuster for their chemistry. He was a pure basic science person, never read a mystery in his life, okay? And the other was a wonderful priest friend of mine who works out of the Vatican. But I went to him with a question, and then he wanted to read the book, so I sent it to him. All three of them said, you have to publish this. We'll see.
Well, I think that's great.
And the reason I ask if you were Jewish, because one of the characters that's a minor, very minor role, but he's a rabbi. And he's a wonderful guy, and he's got some wonderful, there are things that come out that I didn't even know I had in me. Like, this rabbi says at one point, you can approach life trying to understand it like a jigsaw puzzle. So you can view life as all one color, or you can view life as a beautiful picture with the sky and trees and birds and flowers and people. Now, which jigsaw puzzle do you think you want to work with? Now, where did that come from in my head? I don't know, but it made perfect sense to me.
That's an amazing process to have gone through, you know?
Oh, you should. And now I'm going nuts trying to find an agent because, if I want it to be published, I at least have to try. I mean, I can get it published. But we'll see.
Well, that's an amazing process. And I hope that works out. I'm really glad you told about it because, you know, I mean, that's real vulnerability, you know, embarking on something like that. It's like going into terra incognita, you know.
And, you know, there's when the character, the woman, doctor, former nun, when she talks about her husband, she talks about two favorite songs, the music. And I can't listen to them now because they're two of mine. One is the Sergio Leone suite from Once Upon a Time in America. Have you ever heard it?
Yeah, Oh yeah, great movie. Yeah.
Well, the movie, I've never even seen the movie, but do you have Amazon? Do you have Alexi? Ask her to play Sergio Leone's Suite by Yo-Yo Ma.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The person who wrote it was Ennio Morricone. And I cannot listen to that without getting choked up. Mm. So I try not to listen to it.
Right, right. What's the other piece?
So beautiful.
What's the other piece of music?
Well, there's Time to Say Goodbye. Mm. With God, what's his name? I'm blocking. The Italian singer, the tenor.
Pavarotti?
No. He sings this with the woman. Da 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 da.
Don't recognize. Think of it.
Yeah, I'll think of it and I'll let you know.
We can end it. Yeah. Well, shall we leave it there for today?
Okay.
Pick up the next part of the story, the post-sabbatical. I'm really glad you told that story. You know, it's a nice window into how you're seeing yourself now. It's a really good one.
Okay. Wonderful.
Well,
take care and take care of yourself, all right?
Thank you. You too. And for the record, I'm turning off the recorder at 3:12 my time, 4:12 Dr. DeAngelis' time. And we'll make a time for next week.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.